I came across one half of a manifesto by Jaron Lanier, published more than 20 years ago back in 2000. I think its time has come due. Lanier is one of the progenitors of this mega project, this Silicon Manhattan project, if you will, to transform our civilization into one that is steered completely by technology. And I think the real point here is that despite all the promise of technology for our society, the level of red flags makes it very hard to get excited about it or to readily accept it, because the things we might lose are so obvious.
You will die in the explosion.
And they're fundamental. What kind of society do we want it to be? What kind of society do we want to live in? It's not clear how much sway we, the plebs, even have in that scenario, but our unchecked, unconditional participation is contributing to the phenomena. Jaron Lanier writes in part, "And so I'll here share my thoughts with the respondents of Edge.org, many of whom, as much as anyone, are responsible for this revolution, one which champions the ascent of cybernetic technology as culture. The dogma I object to is composed of a set of interlocking beliefs and doesn't have a generally accepted overarching name as yet, though I sometimes call it cybernetic totalism. It has the potential to transform human experience more powerfully than any prior ideology, religion, or political system ever has, partly because it could be so pleasing to the mind, at least initially, but mostly because it gets a free ride on the overwhelmingly powerful technologies that happen to be created by people who are, to a large degree, true believers. I hope no one will think I'm equating cybernetics with what I'm calling cybernetic totalism. The distance between recognizing a great metaphor and treating it as the only metaphor is the same as the distance between humble science and dogmatic religion. The fact is that the technocratic elite, based largely in Silicon Valley and interwoven now within almost every strata of government, military, finance, business, have immeasurable power over the emerging era of civilization, and chances are we haven't seen anything yet.
There's been this incredible concentration of wealth and power, much of it for the people who are closest to the big computers in one way or another. There are many things going on that are destabilizing and harming the world, but I think one of them is this looming sense of people becoming obsolete. I heard questions I've never heard before. I heard questions of the form, well, if we're going to be obsolete, why did our parents have us? What is the point? And I think this sense that the technologists are about to make people obsolete is having a deleterious effect on the world along with all the other things.
But as much as grand scenarios and royal F-ups may form our mental picture of the danger of these new powers in society and the dominance of AI, Lanier draws our attention to some of the smaller dangers which are challenging us all in relatively small ways, manipulating our behavior thoroughly, yet gradually, and at many levels invisibly, in ways that may be making us worse as humans through everyday interactions. He writes in part, "The distance between the ideal computers we imagine in our thought experiments and the real computers we know how to unleash on the world could not be more bitter."
The Skynet funding bill is passed. Human decisions are removed from strategic defense. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, August 29th. In a panic, they try to pull the plug.
As much as AI could result in a dark, draconian, dystopic reality befitting of a proper Hollywood nightmare, just for example, Terminator 2, as much as that could happen and is strangely a realistic scenario, our submission to inferior technologies, bad moderation, lazy code, and other unforeseen consequences that, while important, would never make a good movie, these kinds of things, in socializing people through algorithmically determined patterns, they could simply debase our human instincts and demoralize and deteriorate us just a bit more than we may have realized. This exposure to small horrors like AI content moderation or AI credit scores or social credit systems, just to start the conversation rolling, these things can be ongoing under cover of the larger what-if scenarios that foresee big cataclysms, huge catastrophic events on the near horizon. that would hypothetically be brought on when computers become ultra-intelligent masters of matter and life. And so really this manifesto comes about shortly after Ray Kurzweil's Age of Intelligent Machines, Bill Joy's essay in Wired, warning about the human race becoming submissive to an artificial intelligence. It comes in the wake of the Unabomber Manifesto, the Ted Kaczynski warnings about technology, and Lanier inserts, you know, kind of the reverse criticism of what if the problem isn't that computers become ultra-intelligent, but that we put ourselves under the thumb of a system that is not more intelligent, but less of a system that instead of working flawlessly works like crap and is like comparable to bad bureaucracies, bad governments. So that's the subject matter we get to, and it still crystallizes as being quite relevant now. In fact, you can kind of see which parts of it make sense. Lanier delves into six layers of what he terms the cybernetic totalist belief system that's created a problem of deterministic doom for humanity, who've been in many ways put on track to be reorganized as hostages in a society that would control, track, trace, and steer society as a means to ward off domination or annihilation at the hands of AI. By a system gone awry that man has been creating deliberately, that gains in its own self-interest of control of people through the pretext of losing control to intelligent machines, right? We're still in the territory of problem reaction solution. We're still in the territory of crisis management. The progressive stages of this list, the beliefs that they comprise, as they compound, gradually take away more and more agency from individuals, both theoretically and where it's put into practice, minimizing the significance of the human species, reducing people to mere machinery as part of a vast biological and informational complex of which the population are to become increasingly passive participants. And things are already very centralized, huge governmental blocks, global systems, integrated standardized technology, displacement of human labor by automation. If you really stop to think about it, so many layers of the way things are have already been kind of worked out. And at the very least, they encourage people to just repeat that and go along with the flow and just sort of agree to the way things have been worked out, which is fine when it's a good solution. But overall, I think it asks people to be less thoughtful, to do less of their own problem solving. And so things that could get better won't get better any faster.
Many issues are real. They're not just fantasy issues. They're existential real issues. And the question is, are we still able to have a conversation about reality or not? That becomes the existential question of the moment. And so far, the way we've been running things has been pulling us away from reality. That scares me, and I think that's the core darkness that we have to address. We can survive everything else, but we cannot survive if we fail to address that.
Lanier on cybernetic totalism. He describes these as component beliefs of a cybernetic totalism. Number one, that cybernetic patterns of information provide the ultimate and the best way to understand reality. And he argues, quoting in part, there's an undeniable rush of excitement. While I believe I can imagine what a thrill it must have been to use early photographic equipment in the 19th century, I can't imagine that any outsider could comprehend the sensation around early computer graphics technology in the 1970s. For here was not merely a way to make and show images, but a meta framework that subsumed all possible things. Once you can understand something in a way that you can shove it into a computer, you've cracked its code. It was as if we had become the gods of vision and had effectively created all possible images.
This is all so new.
It's not new. I realize that nothing we've been doing is new. We haven't been tapping into new areas of the brain. We've just been awakening the most ancient.
And over my left shoulder, an orange figure. Well, these changing images are being generated by computer in direct response to the movements of my head. I'm actually standing in an invisible electromagnetic field being transmitted from up there. Signals from three perpendicular receiving coils and a sensor on the helmet here tell the computer where my head is in that field and which direction my head is pointing in.
And you've got to kind of know in a deeply philosophical way what an image is, what that really means. We're not just talking about watching TV or flipping through photographs. We're not just talking about a likeness.
What I see when I look at you is, in fact, my image of you. Or you see your image of me. The how of using our senses is a deeply concealed body of knowledge.
It's something about this mirror world of representation. It's almost kind of a straw man situation, a synthetic rendition that is like swapped out for you.
In addition to stereoscopic depth cues, the system provides full motion parallax and motion perspective cues that allow the operator to explore virtual objects in real time.
Very few people seem to realize the enormous theoretical power of this distinction between what I see and what is actually out there.
Go look up the definition. I mean, it's a fascinating topic that Mel and I have had ongoing interest in, particularly since we studied cybernetics.
This technology is simply a route to powers that conjurers and alchemists used centuries ago. Human race lost that knowledge, and now I'm reclaiming it through virtual reality.
What is the image? What is it that we're seeing? What does that mean? Lanier writes in part, the cybernetic impulse is initially driven by ego. Cybernetic totalists look at culture and see memes and autonomous mental tropes that compete for brain space in humans, somewhat like viruses. In doing so, they not only accomplish a triumph of campus imperialism, placing themselves in an imagined position of superior understanding versus the whole of the humanities.
Another part of it is what I call nerd imperialism. And what that means is that the nerd mentality, the nerd mindset, would like to subsume all the other ones. So all the people who are interested in art or design, all the people who are interested in sociology, the people who are interested in politics, the people who are interested in psychology, the people who live subjectively and are interested in the impressions of the world, the people who believe in interiority and are interested in their own experience, the nerd imperialist would like to overwhelm and control and be superior to all of these. And it's kind of happened because we make so much money. We make, you know, the biggest companies are tech companies now, and they've come up very quickly. We're outpacing even the pharmaceuticals. We're kind of kings in a way. And so, when somebody has that kind of good fortune, they always read it as confirmation of their high self-regard. And so naturally we think, yes, this whole business of replacing people with something we invent, of course it makes sense.
But they also avoid having to pay much attention to the particulars of culture in a given time and place. Once you've subsumed something into its cybernetic reduction. So once you agree that studying the pattern of information is the best and ultimate way to understand it, everything else that doesn't change that basic formula becomes less important. Isn't that what he's saying? These cybernetic totalists don't just start with the cybernetic pattern of information. In of itself, that is not the problem. It's definitely a useful tool for thinking about things. For modeling society, for studying the way things work. But part of the problem is assuming at all that this is something that has been solved. On top of the cybernetic patterns, Lanier names number two that people are no more than cybernetic patterns. Number three, that subjective experiences either don't exist or is unimportant because it is in some sort of ambient or peripheral effect. And that's part of reducing us all to cybernetic functionality.
No, you're trying to get inside my head, Job.
You realize, Dr. Angelo, that my intelligence has surpassed yours. And I can't allow your fear of what you don't understand to get in the way of this work.
And you begin to sense how all of this compounds upon itself. When one viewpoint or belief is contingent on the next, it shuts out other modes of thought and, you know, it leads to this tunnel vision thing. Is sort of the engine of all of society. It becomes a lot more important what those biases are and what things are being shut out. Even if the things they're saying are true or mostly true or useful or even strong arguments, even if they're scientifically proven, there still may be other things to consider.
Mind over matter, Dr. Angelo. Not a miracle. A fact.
I have to run some tests.
So he gets into number four, that what Darwin described in biology or something like it is in fact also the singular superior description of all creativity and culture. And again, the tendency to assume that the Darwinian theory works so well that nothing else even has to be considered. Building upon that, number five, the qualitative as well as quantitative aspects of information systems will be accelerated by Moore's law. And sometimes better is worth more than greater quantities of lesser. I mean, we know this generally. Being able to consume all of the data and information produced by a society is not the same as really understanding what people are saying. Generally, collectively, individually, it's not the same as being able to understand nuance, even if you're seeing very important patterns. I think you have to get the qualitative right in order for the quantitative to even fully matter, especially if you're talking about an ultimate system, which appears to be what they're trying to have go on.
You're moving too fast. Even with all these new abilities, there are dangers. Man may be able to evolve a thousandfold through this technology, but the rush must be tempered with wisdom.
And finally, Lanier says the most dramatic is number six, that biology and physics will merge with computer sciences, becoming biotech and nanotech, resulting in life and the physical universe becoming mercurial, achieving the supposed nature of computer software. Furthermore, that all of these things will happen very soon. Since computers are improving so quickly, it's the belief that they will overwhelm all the other cybernetic processes, like people, because people are also cybernetic, and will fundamentally change the nature of what's going on in the familiar neighborhood of Earth at some moment when a new criticality is achieved, maybe in about the year 2020. To be a human after that moment will be either impossible or something very different than we now can know. So Lanier sets up for a discussion about the compounding philosophy of reductive human and cybernetic control systems, where average individuals just aren't left with a lot of power, not in the bigger questions. It's part of a problem of insular thinking, academia and the ivory tower, that sort of thing. And it naturally gives way, or could naturally give way, to a dogmatic belief in some kind of moment of totalism where AI technological systems would completely take over the world and every sense of the known universe, and our lives thereafter would become a function of this techno-metabolic society. And so again, Lanier is putting it out there. He is making a significant criticism, so let's take it for what it is.
I can attempt to theorize why this holds so much sway in the technical community. Why is tech culture so obsessed with this idea of creating fake people and of believing that it's creating a new life form? Well, one theory is that it's mostly men and it's some sort of a womb envy kind of a thing, that we want to give life. It's a way of not needing women anymore. We can propagate life without them. Part of it is it's an effective plot for science fiction, and so much compelling science fiction has been made out of the idea of computers coming alive. We could mention the Matrix movies and the Terminator movies and on and on and on. That's had a big, big role. And if you look at these movies and you think, wow, science fiction does kind of say something about the future of technology, then what you think to yourself is AI is power in the future, so we better be the ones to make AI first, and it better be our AI. Once again, this sense of the race, this all-or-nothing race where nothing else matters.
The warnings about this have been there for some time, and film, movies, culture, TV, it reflects this. HAL 9000 takes over the ship, Skynet will wipe out John Connor's human resistance movement, Johnny Depp's Transcendence warns against the hive mind pawns that humans could quickly become, and the horror that is resurrecting a real human personality brought back to life and impersonated by an AI system, and so many other examples, on and on.
I mean, a lot of my colleagues in Silicon Valley grew up on science fiction, and we have in our heads the Matrix movies and the Terminator and Commander Data and all of these things. And these images are so powerful that we think in those terms.
The Cold War yielded the realpolitik maxim that anything short of nuclear war was allowable, or at least better, if it didn't trigger nuclear war. And thus, proxy wars and regime change flourished the world over in a wave of conflict that saw dictators and autocrats remain rather than be removed from power. This type of containment at the local level becomes typical of Cold War attitudes that enabled large-scale collectivist societies to be sustained under the conditions that led to World War II in the first place. The West and East both become blocks of this larger government of shadow control, and the technology defines the relationship of these governments to its people. The accessible levers of power in that system, the ones available to the average person from the ballot box on up, become more and more insignificant in the wake of this systemic machinery. In a similar vein, the automatic investment AI systems can make millions of transactions in mere seconds, pick up on trends, and basically know where to invest in ways that individuals certainly couldn't keep up with, and even well-organized investors would have a hard time competing with without sharing in the use of this AI technology. Predictive modeling itself puts society on the track of being easily manipulated by AI and other computational systems. And the black box steers and controls society to a degree never before known in history. Policy words censor, distribute, promote, or bury content according to its weight and value under information policies. It's much more the Leviathan now than it ever was in Thomas Hobbes' time.
Within the tech community, you'll often hear, and by the tech community, I mean the very most powerful, wealthy, and influential individuals, my friends, in many cases, you'll often hear an argument like, well, it's fine for you to worry about global warming. It's fine for you to worry about whether there'll be enough fresh water when we hit peak population later in the century. It's fine for you to worry about the danger of emerging new infectious diseases as populations travel around the world. You can worry about all that stuff, but it doesn't really matter. The only thing that really matters is the AI race, because the AI will be smart enough to solve all those things. So everything else is a waste of time. It's the singular focus on this fetish object. You can say it's a little bit like the golden calf in the Old Testament, of a sort of a flowering of vanity, of people believing that they can be God. Which is, I think, a natural thing to want. It's difficult to be a person. We die. Mortality is very difficult. And this gives you a fantasy of some other status, some other story. That's a very big part of it.
Circling back around to the second and sixth beliefs, respectively, that are broken down in Lanier's Half Manifesto, the beliefs that people are, on the one hand, no more than cybernetic patterns, and the belief, on the other hand, in a coming cybernetic cataclysm, these things are worth goalposting. Let's talk about the distance between them and what it means. And obviously, contemporary humans are completely vulnerable to the problems that are posed here. These are the two main issues, the two biggest overarching things that for me came out of this paper that I want to deal with here today. It boils down to the inverse problem of inferior technology or bad or even sinister applications, which affect a sort of mirror and repeat effect that makes humans something less than human instead of the prophesied more than human result that would come from confronting or even merging with massively advanced technology.
Would you like another?
Extra big-ass fries!
I said I didn't get any.
Thank you. Your account has been charged. Your balance is zero. Please come back when you can afford to make a purchase.
No.
I'm sorry you're having
trouble.
Come on!
And as a subset, the clumsiness revealed by this problem gives way to the second issue, dealing with the submission of the population at large to the creator's bias, known or unknown, programmed, pre-programmed into this technology, you know, put there as a preference or a policy by the creator, but basically not known to the larger human user base.
My kids are starving.
This should help you calm down.
This should help you calm down.
Lanier writes in part regarding belief number two, every cybernetic totalist fantasy relies on artificial intelligence. It might not be immediately apparent why such fantasies are essential to those who have them. If computers are to become smart enough to design their own successors, initiating a project that will lead to godlike omniscience, someone is going to have to write the software that gets the process going. And humans have given absolutely no evidence of being able to write such software. So the idea is that the computers will somehow become smart on their own and write their own software.
Man makes man in his own image. This seems to be the echo or the prototype of the act of creation by which God is supposed to have made man in his image. Can something similar occur in the less complicated and therefore more understandable case of non-living systems that we call machines? What is the image of a machine? Can this image, as embodied in one machine, bring a machine of a general sort not yet committed to a particular specific identity to reproduce the original machine, either absolutely or under some change that may be construed as a variation? Can the new and varied machine itself act as an archetype, even as to its own departures from its own archetypal pattern? It is to the purpose of the present section to answer these questions, and to answer them by yes.
My primary objection to this way of thinking is pragmatic. It results in the creation of poor quality real-world software in the present. You see, because things are going to be so great one day, it doesn't matter what it's like today. And it's true, things like computer graphics have advanced, but still, cybernetic totalists live with their heads in the future and are willing to accept obvious flaws in the present software in support of a fantasy world that might never appear. Let's start at the beginning, when the idea first appeared. In Turing's famous thought experiment, a human judge is asked to determine which of the two correspondents is human and which is a machine. If the judge can't tell, Turing asserts that the computer should be treated as having essentially achieved the moral and intellectual status of personhood. Turing's mistake was that he assumed that the only explanation for a successful computer entrant would be that the computer has become elevated in some way by becoming smarter, more human. But there's another equally valid explanation of a winning computer, however, which is that the human had become less intelligent, less human-like. An official Turing test is held every year, but my view is that this event is distracting everyone from the real Turing tests that are already being won. Real, though miniature, Turing tests are happening all the time, every day, whenever a person puts up with a stupid computer software. For instance, in the United States, we organize our financial lives in order to look good to the pathetically simplistic computer programs that determine our credit ratings. We borrow money when we don't need to, for example, to feed the type of data to the programs that we know they are programmed to respond to favorably. In doing this, we make ourselves stupid in order to make the computer software seem smart. The AI belief system is a direct explanation for a lot of bad software in the world, such as the annoying features and Microsoft Word and PowerPoint that guess at what the user really wanted to type. There are many, many examples of these types of things, spinoffs and counterparts. Putting a complete list together here would be a real chore, but hopefully you get the idea. Not only is part of the problem that a frustrating half-assed solution would be presented to society as though it were a solution, but every faux authority that is presented to us that we're meant to deal with, even if they're acting unconstitutionally outside of jurisdiction, even if technically what they do is done by participants voluntarily, but most of those people feel like they have to, things like checkpoints and scans, passwords for authorization, admittance, allowance, all the frustrations surrounding that, it's those types of questions. Either you know what I mean or you don't, I guess. A tumorous growth of the no one to appeal to problems of early phone robots, online return chatbots, other non-human arbiters of human transactions. While many transactions are straightforward and time and energy could be saved, and sometimes are for sure, efficiently sorting out some of the details, there's still many gray areas where transactions, pleading your case type of stuff is too complicated for these systems to handle, and their inability to understand it becomes an injustice to the customer, to the user, to the citizen who doesn't have the means to appeal to a higher authority, or the system doesn't have an option for that, and their inability to plead the case means they don't get a fair dealing. All too plausible in its expectations for tech to ruin our lives by incompetence and furthermore the relinquishment of human oversight to dumber than human machines. I mean, as Lanier writes, there's no difference between machine autonomy and the abdication of human responsibility. This fundamental problem is complicated by the belief, stated or sincere, held by many prominent technocrats that such small problems are essentially speed bumps because humanity is getting smarter all the time.
Right. The correct answer is that everyone gets smarter because of this technology.
Now, the present-day electronic brains are complete morons, but this will not be true in another generation. They will start to think, and eventually they will completely outthink their makers.
Always getting smarter. AI systems are also always getting smarter, always better, always more efficient, and grander solutions are coming, while ordinary people must deal with suffering whatever problems arise in the meantime. Cybernetic totalism is thus the subjugation of human society as a whole to these forces on the belief that the emerging evolution of the system will be lifting and positive for society, at least until it isn't. And the hypnotic magnetism of this existential crisis mixed with cataclysm is that we must hurl towards the light of this dilemma at breakneck speeds, no time to stop and think, no time to test for safety, pass and go, collecting $200, and seizing up the whole board game, all the game, all its pieces and assets in an all-or-nothing race to collectivize as humans and then collectivize with the existing and emerging technology in one continuous process that, again, just stamps over individuals in many ways that are going to matter and already do.
What's in this box? What's in this box? What's in this box?
And in one sense, this is taking place in the quest to meet or stave off the disaster of runaway AI. And one of the examples that comes to mind is, you know, Gil Scott-Heron sang about Whitey on the Moon because poverty was endemic in his community and in this country generally. And yet all this money, all this technology, all this progress, all the best minds, all the thinkers are trying to get a couple of people into space, get us to the moon. Today they say we're going to Mars. And some amazing new technologies would allow that to happen, great sums of money and all that. But what kind of culture are we exporting to another realm, to another planet? We haven't solved poverty. We haven't solved the dilemma of social interaction. Who are we to export ourselves when we haven't even figured out the basics? We could throw all the money in the world at a new technology, but we can't figure out how to live right. That's a qualitative over quantitative problem. Thus, the second main issue is a complication of these first parts, dealing with the scripted grand final belief, number six, that of a driving belief that indoctrinates the elite steersmen of society and thus keeps out dissent, silences naysayers, throws caution to the wind in a believer believes his own BS scenario that intensifies all the rest of the problem. Putting risks aside to meet the cataclysmic problems and racing ahead could mean absorbing a lot of risk in a society that wouldn't have been otherwise tolerated. Shocks justified and all compounding into a pre-scripted destination, a self-fulfilling prophecy that would cybernetically create the runaway train to meet the needs of a society that had prepared for just such an off-the-rails cataclysmic scenario, right? Give us the problem we've been imagining. It's worse than a qualitative over quantitative problem if you bring the problem into being. Here Lanier writes on belief number six, the coming cybernetic cataclysm. When a thoughtful person marvels at Moore's law, there might be awe and there might be terror. One version of the terror was expressed recently by Bill Joy in a cover story for Wired magazine. Bill accepts the pronouncements of Ray Kurzweil and others who believes that Moore's law will lead to autonomous machines, perhaps by the year 2020. That is when computers will become, according to some estimates, about as powerful as human brains. Not that anyone knows enough, really, to measure brains against computers yet, but for the sake of argument, let's suppose that the comparison is meaningful. According to this scenario of terror, computers won't be stuck in boxes. They'll be like robots connected together on the net, and they'll have quite a bag of tricks. They'll be able to perform nanomanufacturing, for one thing. They'll quickly learn to reproduce and improve themselves, and one fine day, without warning, the new super machines will brush humanity aside as casually as humans clear a forest for a new development. Or perhaps the machines will keep humans around to suffer the sort of indignity portrayed in the movie The Matrix. Even if the machines would otherwise choose to preserve their human progenitors, evil humans will be able to manipulate the machines to do vast harm to the rest of us. This is a different scenario that Bill also explores. Biotechnology will have advanced to the point that computer programs will be able to manipulate DNA as if it were JavaScript. If computers can calculate the effects of drugs, genetic modifications, and other biological trickery, and if the tools to realize such tricks are cheap, then all it takes is one madman to, say, create an epidemic targeted at a single race. Biotechnology without a strong, cheap information technology component would not be sufficiently potent to bring about this scenario. Cyberneticians like Donald McKay have warned about the potential for predictive models to drive outcomes, even when undesirable. This scenario, which portends scripting our own doom, is often not recognized as the distraction of the seemingly inevitable yet larger-than-life cataclysm keeps impending doom waiting in the wings on our minds indefinitely. A form of tunnel vision within the industry clouds judgment, enables supervillains, and endangers all of us to the stupidity manifest in the machine with no feedback power in the hands of the ordinary. Nothing meaningful, anyway. Yeah, there might be room for grumblings or some customer service, but not an actual ability to change the higher policies. And Jared Lanier has been inside this revolution, apparently taken aback on a regular basis by the warning signs going ignored all around him with the people he knows, some of them his colleagues, others in the industry. The day before 9/11, rebooting civilization. While you were about to be smacked in the face by the monstrous history of 9/11, quite the cataclysm, these men and a few women were gathered together to discuss rebooting civilization. This was literally the topic of two seminars hosted by the Edge Foundation's John Brockman, looking conspiratorial as fuck in this chic photo of the group. The meeting, neither the first nor the last of its kind, is more of a touchstone in terms of chronicling the esoteric rise of technology into a governing system for a highly literate, politically radicalized, and modernized population organized around major city centers forged out of public and private arrangements. This broadly distributed but tightly networked society would grow analogous to the Internet itself, which developed out of the ARPANET project of 69, and it's also modeled on the neural nets of the human brain, how neuron firing works, based on what they know so far, which the original cyberneticians paralleled directly with computing and used as a model to replicate in proto-artificial intelligence and machine learning projects. They tried to train them to work like neural nets and thus, in theory, to compute like the human brain. This Department of Defense Advanced Research Project in turn laid down the foundations not only for the Internet as we know it, but more broadly as the cornerstone of the information society layer of our life, where a predominance of articulated language now resides and is exchanged. The expressions, the signals, and telltale communicators underneath the skull, EEG, those things are also being uncovered, and cognitive liberty is being debated as the veil between our private brain and the greater world of communication is being torn, is being thinned. ARPANET, by laying out our remade world, is dealing with not merely a modern or technologically advanced civilization, but a veritable new epoch of civilization itself, quite set apart from all previous iterations of civilization, appropriately forged by J.C.R. Licklider himself. Under military auspices with military funding, who comes from the meeting circles of interdisciplinary disciples who met together at the Macy's cybernetic conferences and in those circles during the 40s and 50s, the group that we covered in The Minds of Men. Whatever the true revolution is of these cyberneticians, these technocrats, you know, it's very interesting. They were meeting on literally rebooting civilization on what turned out to be the day before 9/11, which clearly kicked things into a new era on a new and in many ways horrible path. And a little less than a year before 9/11, at the turning point of the new millennia, Jaron Lanier published his own one half of a manifesto paper at Edge.org in November 2000. Still relevant now, 20 years later, perhaps even more so. Lanier writes in part, "For the last 20 years, I found myself on the inside of a revolution, but on the outside of its resplendent dogma. Now that the revolution has not only hit the mainstream, but bludgeoned it into submission by taking over the economy, it's probably time for me to cry out my dissent more loudly than I have before." So, getting back to his paper, the problem of bad coding, stupid software, bad design, etc. is complicated by bad policies, ones that stem from tunnel vision or arrogance of singular belief system, with a dangerous belief that mob rule is good for shutting down alternative voices and that this is still somehow compatible with democracy. It's also bad for deliberately discriminatory policies. These get built into the technology. And this is a reiteration of the quantity versus quality problem. If you do get some kind of discriminatory policy, the computer becomes very good at picking these things out, but the policy, qualitatively, is unfair. It's totally biased, but the machine's programmed to work that way, right?
What are computers very good at? Infinite memory, very good needle in the haystack problems, and an awful lot of data analysis.
So Lanier's criticized a lot of things, social media and mob rule, and he wrote in 2006 on digital Maoism, the hazards of the new online collectivism. He writes in part that is nothing less than a resurgence of the idea that the collective is all wise and that it's desirable to have influence concentrated in a bottleneck that can channel the collective with the most verity and force. This is different from representative democracy or meritocracy. This idea has dreadful consequences when thrust upon us from the extreme right or the extreme left in various historical periods. The fact that it's now being reintroduced today by prominent technologists and futurists, people who in many cases I know and like, doesn't make it any less dangerous. The threat of the mob is balanced against the very real threats of a widening wealth gap, another thing that Lanier talks about, and the concentration of any real financial power into the hands of blocks that can invest massive market-shifting amounts of money in real time based upon recommendations from the algorithms that have been simulated to evolve to program market conditions and basically are prepared for more scenarios than the black book of a football coach who's won a bunch of championship games, you know. So Lanier writes in part here in the one half of a manifesto, "Among the many processes that information systems make more efficient is the process of capitalism itself. A nearly friction-free economic environment allows fortunes to be accumulated in a few months instead of a few decades. But the individuals doing the accumulating are still living as long as they used to, longer in fact. So those individuals who are good at getting rich have a chance to get richer before they die, more so than their equally talented forebears. The greater danger is that the gulf between the richest and the rest could become transcendentally grave. That is, even if we agree that a rising tide raises all ships, if the rate of the rising of the highest ships is greater than that of the lowest, they will become ever more separated. And indeed, concentrations of wealth and poverty have increased during the internet boom years in America." That's what he said 20 years ago, and it's just been a problem that's intensified, really. "If Moore's Law or something like it is running the show, the scale of the separation could become astonishing. This is where my terror resides, in considering the ultimate outcome of the increasing divide between the ultra-rich and the merely better off. With the technologies that exist today, the wealthy and the rest aren't all that different. Both bleed when pricked, for the classic example. But with the technology of the next 20 or 30 years, they might become quite different indeed. Will the ultra-rich and the rest even be recognizable as the same species by the middle of the new century? The possibility that they will become essentially different species are so obvious and so terrifying that there's almost a banality in stating them. Let's explore just one possibility for the sake of argument. One day, the richest among us could turn nearly immortal, becoming virtual gods to the rest of us, in the sense that biotechnology hopes to manage the processes of biology in ever greater detail, leading at some far horizon to perfect control. In other words, bad software will make biological hacks like near immortality expensive instead of cheap in the future. Even if everything else gets cheaper, the information technology side of the effort will get more expensive. Cheap near immortality for everyone is a self-limiting proposition. There isn't enough room to accommodate such an adventure."
"I've got the gun in my hand here. I hate to do this to you right now, but you're gone, John. You're history."
Also, roughly speaking, if immortality was to become cheap, so would the horrific biological weapons of Bill's scenario. On the other hand, expensive near immortality is something the world could absorb, at least for a good long while, because there would be fewer people involved. Maybe they could even keep the effort quiet. So here is the irony. The very features of computers which drive us crazy today and keep so many of us gainfully employed are the best insurance our species has for long-term survival as we explore the far reaches of technological possibility. On the other hand, the same annoying qualities are what could make the 21st century into a madhouse scripted by the fantasies and desperate aspirations of the super rich. And I'm not sure I really agree with the gist of that, that it would be better if just a few people pursued immortality. To me, I mean, we made a video on this. It's really just the real wealth gap that some people can afford to fix all of their problems and live a very long time, almost forever, while everyone else becomes trash. They can't even afford health care, and the health care they get does not meaningfully address some of the more important problems. He's knocking right on the door of eugenics, and the idea that there could be a secret project for the immortality of an elite, that could be going on and even kept quiet, well, that manifest, that actually came to pass. It brings us back to the larger paradox at hand, the promise of being controlled in order to limit external control by AI cataclysm that we will have created and encouraged in so many ways. And Lanier points out things related to this, you know. The future birth of a more so, more than human species is usually said to be related to computers. It's certainly the picture they're painting. He later writes with some irony that just as a newborn race of super intelligent robots are about to consume all of humanity, our dear old species will likely be saved by a Windows crash.
It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device, and it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner built, whoa.
That must be why we're not shipping Windows 98 yet.
Absolutely.
So he's actually arguing that the smaller problems are both a problem and potentially our saviors from the greater AI cataclysm. That maybe this stuff is not actually up to snuff, and the picture of this all-powerful, all-knowing, godlike AI system may just be a myth, a fantasy, you know? There's so much more to the recipe that could see us dwarfed by a pseudo-species capable of dominating everything we do. It's one which could exterminate humanity, it could blur it out of existence, dominate it, or it could render us to be mere pets or matrix batteries, but it will at least manipulate the behavior of humanity as a whole. It's aiming to and functioning as bringing it under technocratic control by means of the very perceived looming threat of AI dominance that is projected, right? The very problem posed by a super intelligent, super powerful AI is the organizing belief that is manipulating humanity to bring itself further under technocratic control. We are feeding into the problem. Do you see that?
Right. The correct answer is that everyone gets smarter because of this technology.
So all you're looking at with these AI programs is what other people have done. It's just us. It's just a new kind of social cooperation. But I know the science fiction idea is so appealing and so strong that people just want to go there because it fulfills their fantasies from when they were kids. And, you know,
well, they're nightmares.
Yeah, well, you know the funny thing about it? There's a weird two-edged kind of appeal, because you might say, well, if the fantasy when you were a kid that you saw in all of these movies was that the AIs would take over and destroy humanity – why would you want that? But the thing is, being able to relive, even if it seems very negative, entering into the science fiction of your youth has this kind of appeal. Like, you're the one actually doing it, actually having this power. It's very hard to overcome that. I mean, the science fiction of our youth is almost like, I don't want to use the word religion, but it's like this very deep culture in us. And so it becomes our vocabulary, it becomes our way of thinking.
In conclusion, whatever is true about technology, it's absolutely changed and fundamentally altered the society we live in and the times into which we've been born. For good or for ill, as they say, it's been the trend and it's not going anywhere. Back in 2000, Lanier wrote, quoting in part, "There's a real chance that evolutionary psychology, artificial intelligence, Moore's law fetishizing, and the rest of the package will catch on in a big way, as big as Freud or Marx did in their times, or bigger, since these ideas might end up essentially built into the software that runs our society and thus our lives. If that happens, the ideology of cybernetic totalist intellectuals will be amplified from novelty into a force that could cause suffering for millions of people."
"That a mind plucked from reality through shutting off the senses could be easily softened, remolded, or even shattered.
The psychological aspects of behavior control would include not only conditioning by repetition and training, but such things as hypnosis, deprivation, isolation, manipulation of guilt feelings, subtle or overt threats, social pressure, and
the greatest crime of Marxism wasn't simply that much of what it claimed was false, but that it claimed to be the sole and utterly complete path to understanding life and reality. Cybernetic eschatology shares with some of history's worst ideologies as a doctrine of historical predestination. There's nothing more gray, stultifying, or dreary than a life lived inside of the confines of a theory. Let us hope that cybernetic totalists learn humility before their day in the sun arrives," end quote.
There's like the artificial intelligence religion makes engineers just loathe giving people control because they want everybody to buy in to this AI religion. They want people to say, yes, the machine is choosing for me. I trust the machine. The machine is becoming alive. They want that so much that they'll destroy the world to get that feeling.
I mean, that's a big pill that Jaron is having a swallow here. But he's right. The madness of believing your own bullshit, of modeling it for society, and getting us all to feed into our own predestined cataclysm is insane, and yet it's so intoxicating that it's difficult to stop or step out of. And so it's difficult to know for sure how things will turn out and how humanity will be reshaped and remolded. But the early results in this process of change are deeply concerning. Again, a lot of red flags.
This is what I would call almost a stealthy addiction. We'll get them hooked through a scheme of rewards and punishment. And the rewards are when you're retweeted. The punishment is when you're treated badly by others online. And then within that, we'll very gradually start to leverage that to change them. So it's this very kind of stealthy manipulation of the population.
This is difficult to keep in mind in large part because technological advance has so often been presented as a critically imminent crisis of apocalyptic proportions. Every prescient warning in the form of dystopian books or films, for all their poise as cautionary tales, as much as I personally love them for that, they're also fueling the fears about the future. That scenario of AI becoming sentient and replacing humanity may not be the real threat as much as the fear of that scenario happening. That's what could be fueling a more imminent problem in the form of a societal puppeteer using the idea of a crisis to steer compliance, to urge acceptance, and to ultimately compel participation from the population who are acting out of fear, right?
The problem is that behaviorist techniques are often invisible to the person who's being manipulated. And this has a long history. This has been done for a long time. It used to be that the only way to be subjected to continuous observation and modification was to either be in an experiment, or you could join a cult, or you could be in an abusive relationship. I mean, this has been done before. And often the people who are in these situations do not realize it's happening to them. In fact, the whole point is that it's sneaky.
In any case, the potential for short-sightedness and temporary insanity in the crowd beast is enormous and in direct proportion to the intensity of the fear. And the most potent fears are rooted in our psychology, the deep wellspring that resides within all of us. As a willing participant in this technological revolution, Jaron Lanier has been significant. As an early whiz kid who soon rode the cutting edge of virtual reality, as a chief scientist in the late 90s for the National Tele-Immersion Initiative, as a leading proponent of virtual meeting rooms, etc., and as a lead researcher in Octopus at Microsoft's research division, and on, he's got all kinds of credits. As a critic of this technology, his voice is significant, therefore, as it indicates that there is and actually exists any sort of brakes to go along with the endless gas pedal within the Silicon Manhattan Project. For all the secrecy and all the cheerleading that goes on with it, I mean, it's at least nice to know that somebody who is at all within that is critical, is dissenting against what they're saying, and is saying that they do at least have some kind of problem going on here. Stopping at the occasional red light or red flag might be a good idea, and some balance to the technological hyperbole about the very sort of cybernetic totalism that Lanier describes is absolutely essential. We have to get our minds around this problem that's part of the problem. It isn't just the submission to technology itself that is the problem, but the submission to the titans who are ushering in this technology. And when we are wary of such technological cataclysms, we must be equally wary of the direction that the salesmen are pulling us in. What door are they putting us through to garner our participation in something that might prove to be short-sighted? In keeping with the theme of Lanier's One Half of a Manifesto, we'll leave all the positive benefits of this techno upgrade package to speak for itself. There are positives, but there's a lot of red flags too, because some of the downsides touched upon here in his paper, and generally in a lot of the things that we talk about, these things should be cause for serious concern if they're not outright deal breakers. Anyway, there's more to his paper. I didn't even come close to reading it all. You can go read it, other things he's talked about, but these things jumped out at me as something that needed to be talked about. As AI comes to the fore and we begin to see what it can really do, and we worry about it becoming all-powerful, all-pervasive, omnipotent, let's keep in mind the things that it doesn't do well, and the problems that it doesn't address, and the problems that arise through the usage of it. That's one of the reasons I think this paper is still very relevant.
But even if the future does belong to the robots, our bodies and our brains still have immense untapped potentialities.
The deepest reason that I think we should reframe the mathematics and the engineering that's normally bundled kind of arbitrarily as being the thing that is AI. The reason I think we should reframe that instead as simply technology that people use instead of a life form is a spiritual reason. I find that each moment is remarkable. I am absolutely astonished that I'm experiencing this. I'm absolutely astonished that I'm not a machine. There's this extra thing where I am alive inside this body. I am perceiving. This is can be called consciousness. It can be called experience. It can be called sentience. Whatever you call it, the AI people will say, oh no, that's something we can do with the program. They'll subsume it. So no vocabulary is adequate to describe it, which is maybe appropriate. But this amazing sense that there's something manifestly supernatural in every moment of ordinary life, this thing to me is sacred and absolutely remarkable. It makes me a better scientist. It makes me a better technologist because it reminds me that I don't understand everything. It reminds me that I live only on a little speck of understanding in a sea of mystery. It reminds me of how precious and mysterious other people are, even though I can only go by faith that they are also experiencing. It reminds me of how life is magical, how much gratitude I have to be here. And the loss of that to this AI fantasy of power and greed and ideological empiricism is such a horrible idea. It's such a loss.